So, lecture 23, November 16th, lecture notes, page 210. If you want to help out animals for the holidays, the College of Business Professionals Roundtable is collecting donations for the APL, the Animal Protective League. The food and supply drive will help animals in the Kent community. You can drop stuff off on the third floor of the College of Business outside the Dean's office, which is room 306. Or on the first floor, outside of our undergraduate advising offices, which is room 107. If you're interested, scan the QR code and see what it is they're interested in having you help with. Aw, that's sweet. This was an interesting opportunity that just came across my desk recently. A student of ours held this position. They loved the student. The student is now moving on to an actual position, and they're looking for two students to get involved with social media. So you'll spend your days connecting with clients, managing campaigns, small and large, brainstorming new approaches and products, and overall helping Kent State University Student Media to support their 10 media partners. If you're interested, you can apply. It's open for the spring. If it really works out, it may continue after that. It starts at $10.10 an hour for 12 to 15 hours a week. And if that sounds like you might be interested, jump on board. Get more information from Kay Dilley, or go ahead and apply on Handshake. I don't really care. I'm just mildly curious. Is this interesting to anybody? Something you might do? Nah. Webbies? One of you, maybe? So midterm two results, more or less in. So we have a 7-point curve. That's maybe 2 points, 1 or 2 points higher than usual. So the average with the curve, 72%, which is where I tell you I'll put it if I need to boost it up. Current high score is 105%. The scores aren't final till I get done looking at the proctoring. So I want to digress for a few minutes from course content and talk philosophy about what I'm doing down here on the testing side, because I've gotten some feedback. Some of y'all are petrified in taking your test, and you're afraid to blink. I think I said, if you're not just reading the material that I'm putting out, but also listening to me, I said, I'm not trying to screw you. I just don't want you to screw with me. Did I not say that? So reasonable activity, you know, you look away, hey, Mom, I'm taking a test, whatever, fine. Your cat jumps up on the desk, or in one case, kid jumps up on the desk, fine. Unless the kid is taking a break from a snack to give you test answers, you aren't cheating. That's not what I'm looking for. On the other hand, I just asked a couple students, in a large section like this where a bunch of people don't care a bit about marketing or about business, what percentage of students might be cheating, do you imagine? 1%? 5%? 10%? 10% of 560 students, every test there's, you know, hypothetically, 50 students cheating. You should care about that. I care about it. And so that's why I have restructured the rules in our online proctoring environment so people know what it is they're likely to get caught doing. So again, you're constantly looking away from the screen and moving around and typing. You're cheating. What are you doing? You're looking away to see birds flying out the window and back to the screen. You're okay. So don't get overly paranoid about it. And if you're not cheating, certainly you're not going to be flat. I don't know if that relieved anybody's feelings or if everybody was cool anyhow. Does anybody have any questions about what I'm all about here, what I'm trying to accomplish, or you were one of the people that was overly concerned so I can chat a little bit and get feedback? Or you don't want to say anything. So you have a comment? You came in and did a pencil paper test, which was an option for everybody to do if they wanted to, yeah. So that was an accommodation for anybody who wanted it, yeah. So that was something you know too. Anything else? This way. So I'm a little concerned that I'm making people crazier than they are, but I just don't want you to be cheated by people cheating you, yeah. So that's what I'm all about. All right, so nobody has anything to say on the topic. We're good. Okay, fine. So there's the grades to date. Mini Test 11 is up and running on the usual schedule. It closes on Saturday on the usual schedule. Enhanced Learning, Extra Credit, and Packback, number 8, closes tonight, its usual schedule. The next one will open Thursday and stay open until the Wednesday after Thanksgiving break, so you don't have to worry about it over Thanksgiving. So on to some marketing in the news. Who is into crypto at all? One of our students is a crypto, I don't know, you have a name, crypto head, crypto freak?
Yes.
Okay. So, why FTX's crypto implosion poses major marketing concerns. So let me back up. How many people heard about this major crypto company failing? Is that something we know about? Okay. So FTX's dramatic collapse last week over reports that it is insolvent carries major marketing implications, including a potential spillover effect that could severely impact the future of crypto advertising, a marketing concern. In fact, last Friday, the company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So we're seeing a bit of competition in the marketplace. In this case, what I'm saying, failure of competition. FTX failed. And, of course, if you were any one of the people that had your lifetime savings stash there, good luck. Right now, it's gone. The spiraling of crypto exchange, one of the biggest by trading volume, a player in this year's so-called Super Bowl, Crypto Bowl, reached a fever pitch last Tuesday when Beyonce, the world's largest crypto exchange and one of FTX's biggest rivals, announced plans to acquire FTX. However, this deal soon fell apart after Beyonce took a closer look at FTX's books. Meanwhile, crypto assets like Bitcoin and Ether have dropped to levels not seen in 2 years, and the SEC announced it's opening a probe into how FTX may have been dealing with clients' funds that seem to have disappeared. So a bit about business ethics. As one of the largest advertisers in the crypto space, FTX has garnered mainstream attention via sports sponsorships, celebrity ambassadors, and national TV ads. The company had naming rights over the Miami Heat's home arena, a payment partnership with Reddit, as well as commercials with Tom Brady, Steph Curry, and Larry David. Ad Age named FTX as a top 10 marketer of the year in 2021. So... How we feel.
Hang on. There's a possibility of a trade.
Tom Brady wants a trade. Could he be coming home?
Oh! What did I say?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, trade. We're telling everyone.
I heard she wants to be in L.A.
Dollar two, go. I'm here in Denver.
I give you the new City Hall.
Take that, Tampa.
A trade? Are you sure?
Not a trade. I'm trading crypto.
FTX is the safest and easiest way to buy and sell crypto. It's the best way to get in the game.
He's trading crypto.
Oh.
Hey, y'all. It's not coming. Not coming.
Trade everything but trade, but not don't trade Brady on FTX. Whoops. So this is their immediate strategy, advertising spends. Now, you know, what are we doing next in this domain? Given the bankruptcy, experts doubt that its many partnerships can stay intact. Well, yeah. Celebrity partners are almost certainly going to distance themselves from FTX. Yeah. The practice of using celebrities in crypto marketing has been under fire for some time, but that didn't stop FTX from doubling down with its stars, especially NFL quarterback Tom Brady, who featured in the company's ads in September. So here's the use of celebrities in marketing and maybe the misuse of them to suck people into something that doesn't seem to be all that above board. Now that FTX has collapsed, experts fear that the chapter of mainstream marketing may be at an end. So here's some factors influencing advertisers' choices as they go to spend their money. As for traditional brands operating in or near the crypto world, the future is also uncertain. Growing skepticism around cryptocurrencies could discourage brands from enabling crypto payment options, so their partnerships could be affected. You want to pay for something with crypto coin, with Bitcoin, they say, we're not doing that. On the other hand, marketers are going to be going where audiences are, wherever audiences are in what this is now called Web3, there's going to be a place for brands, so that's not going away. So marketers need to understand and reach their target audiences in legitimate spaces. We'll see what happens next. This was a sad, amusing horror show that KFC got itself caught in. So we talked about robots last time. Sort of a form of a robot would be your social media software that's set up to look at the calendar, find events, and send off notes to your users on their app, yeah? Automation can never replace human ownership of social media. KFC recently sent out a promotional alert on its app telling their customers in Germany to treat themselves to commemorate Kristallnacht, the 1938 Nazi-led pogrom widely considered to be the beginning of the Holocaust. Probably not a great thing to suggest your people go celebrate. So most people in their target audience abhor the start of the Nazi Holocaust. Yeah? KFC sent out a message soon after apologizing and stating that the unapproved message was sent in error, whoops, through a semi-automated push notification on its app linked to calendars that included national observances. By that point, however, it had already received backlash, you think, on social media. So here's automation in social media. The bottom line is someone should have reviewed the calendars to make sure that the content being distributed was appropriate and relevant to their intended target audience. If someone had done their due diligence, this would have flagged it as inappropriate. But bots are imperfect. While there are benefits and needs for companies to schedule some posts, there are also pitfalls, especially with automated pushes. So it's crucial for brands to assess the systems and processes they have in place. We got to manage our social media marketing in useful ways. Sometimes when you're scheduling several days a week's worth of activity at once for various pages, things can get mixed up. A post may end up on the wrong channel with the wrong messaging or be scheduled for the wrong day or time. But you won't know that until the post goes live and you've guessed it. Your customers flag it to you first online. Not quite the same thing, but when I make a mistake on a date or, you know, a page, people email me, oh, yes, thank you, I've made a mistake. Bigger stakes for companies, KFC, than for me. But if that message is offensive, it will not only make your brand seem inept and insensitive, it will also make your brand come off as impersonal, and customers will notice right away. So that's pretty bad brand management. It can have a negative impact on your equity. There is a lot of work and time that goes into managing social and digital spaces for companies. Those who think scheduling and automated tools will help better manage efficiencies should also consider the potential pitfalls when assessing their best approach to building out their digital strategy. So everything automated still needs managed. Finally, I forget, who are my vegetarians? We have some vegetarians, couple. Who doesn't like vegetables? I ain't eating vegetables. Okay, couple folk. Can I get you to eat vegetables? So plant-based brand Holy Veggie drops a heavy metal anthem for healthy eating. It can be considered a victory as a home cook or a care neighbor to surreptitiously stuff zucchini into muffins or carrots or into mac and cheese, serving those dishes to people who routinely shun vegetables. Covert cuisine? But is it more satisfying to wait until the victims finish the meal and then tell them all the ingredients they ate? You just ate zucchini. So, a bit of humor. The new campaign for Holy Veggie, with the saucy tagline, "Ha ha, you just ate vegetables," goes one step further. It adds a hard-driving, heavy metal soundtrack that says says to its unsuspecting snackers, "You just got punked, and your tormentors are really enjoying the moment." Obviously, this is meant to get attention for the brand. The goal of the new campaign is to grab attention in a jam-packed plant-based food space while aiming to put Holy Vegetable in league with powerhouse competitors like Totino's, TGIF, and other staples in the frozen aisle of the grocery store. So we're positioning the brand, we're building our brand image, we're trying to work against competition. Here's one of those ads.
I want a snack.
I'll make cheese sticks.
Cheese.
You loved him for years, you've never eaten vegetables.
Holy Veggie.
Today is the day you teach him a lesson.
Holy Veggie.
A feeling of power is coursing through your veins.
Holy Veggie.
If he knew what you did, he'd think you were a monster.
That's because you are.
You'd be like a god, with Veggie beating God.
You can control him.
He's an apoplectic shock in reality.
vegetables.
Obviously meant to be attention getting and selling, yeah. Knowing we wanted to stand out, heavy metal felt like a surprising approach for not just the category of veggies, but for advertising as a whole. Metal is one of the most mischievous genres, which connects well with the idea underpinning the campaign, so we're getting the message out to the audience. Holy Veggie, which launched in Canada in 2017, has since expanded to the U.S. The brand continues to grow its distribution. Its sweet potato popcorn, mozzarella-style cheese sticks, cauliflower wings, and other products will be available in 6,500 retailers such as Wegmans, Whole Foods, Sprouts, and Fresh Thyme by the end of this year, with some 700 Target stores recently added. So here is the concept of channels of distribution to grow in this new geographic area. Describing the brand as a bit subversive, the co-founder, John Minnell, said he was looking for that same tone in commercials. Partyland's concept takes an old food advertising trope, attending to get your family to eat hard, healthy, and turns it into something completely unexpected and incredibly memorable, getting the consumer to pay attention and remember. This was another one I thought you might find amusing.
Save more, up to 70% on brands everyone loves all season long at Nordstrom Rack.
This one.
He bought wings.
Yeah, wings.
Your kids hate veggies, their brother died.
Vegetables.
Well, I'm the only one laughing. Maybe I'm the only one with kids. I don't know. So most of us know someone who proudly states, I don't like veggies, and those people are our targets. It might seem like we're doing it to them, but we're really doing it for them, so providing consumer value and trying to change consumers' attitudes. We'll see what happens to the brand over time. All right, lecture notes, page 210 and page 382 in the textbook. Continuing our discussion of setting the final price, and we just had ended up thinking about special adjustments to price. So, step six of our process, we looked at the other five steps earlier, are special adjustments to our list quite price or to our quoted price. Something I said. So first of all, we have the idea of quantity discounts. In this case, we're going to offer reductions in the consumer's cost, the unit cost, or the channel member's unit cost, for larger orders. The assumption is that we get economies of scale savings, and we pass some of those on to our customers. Anybody work in a warehouse? Anybody work in a warehouse? Nah. So every order that comes in, right, has to be processed. So the order comes in. And now you've got to find somebody to go find the stuff. They look around. They find the thing. They put it in a basket, a bin, or whatever. They take it back. You've got to fill out that paperwork. You've got to fill out the shipping invoice. You've got to ship the thing out. It's got to get into the shipping area, and off it goes. That takes time, and it costs money. Every time you do it, it takes time, and it costs money. Tell you what I'm going to do. If you don't order one pencil at a time, if you order a gross or a big box, it saves me time and money. I'll pass some of that savings on to you. Quantity discounts, yeah? In non-cumulative quantity discounts, the price reduction is based on a single order. This larger order that I just gave the example of, not that anybody's ordering one pencil, but okay, is expected to reduce our billing costs, our order filling costs, our shipping costs, our sales costs. And so, hey, we'll pass some of that savings along to our customer for that bigger order, right? Another approach to keep people coming back is a cumulative quantity discount. In this case, the price reduction is based on the total quantity purchased over some time of period, a quarter, a year. The goal is to encourage the consumers to return to us for their reorders. Anybody ever have one of these little tickets that if you buy 10 of something, the 11th one is free, that sort of logic? And so occasionally you look at that, you could go to store A or store B, you say, well, what the heck, I'll go to store A, because I eventually get a free one of whatever it is, donuts or coffee or whatever it might be. That's sort of this idea of a cumulative quantity discount, keep you coming back as a marketing strategy. No, buy one, get one free will fall into the category we'll talk about later on when we talk about promotions rather than pricing. And typically that would fall in a category of something called sales promotions. And so it's a limited term thing. Usually it doesn't go on over a long time period. So in the month of November or for the following 2 weeks, buy one, get one free is usually the logic there. So it's an advertising approach rather than a pricing approach, typically. Seasonal discounts are another way to adjust your list price. We're going to reduce our price based on the time that the purchase is made. So what we're trying to do is to reduce seasonal variations, time variations in our sales, trying to even them out a little bit. So we know that the travel industry often offers much lower off-season rates. For some reason, this next question throws people. What is the off-season in Florida? What's the off-season for a hotel in Florida? Yo.
Summer.
Oftentimes people answer the other way. In the summer, many people think it's too hot to go down there. I'm fine wherever I am. So hotel rates will often drop in the summer to encourage people to go to Florida. In the wintertime, when it's cold where you are, people flock to Florida. They don't need to reduce their rates. So they're trying to shift that demand. So these can also be based on day of the week, time of the day. If you're a movie theater, when do people come to your movie theater in general? What day of the week?
Friday,
the weekend. How about Wednesday or Tuesday? Not so much. What time of day do they come? Usually in the evening, for the evening thing. Matinee, they might not come as often. So we have early bird specials for restaurants or movie theaters. Come in my slow time, in my slow period, so that I can even out demand compared to my big period. Here we see the weekend early bird specials at Oak Harbor Cinemas. And so if you come early, you're able to get a reduced fee, a reduced rate, so we're able to spread our demand out a little bit. Here is the early dinner duo. Come in early and find a combination you love for less. That's somewhere. I don't know where that is. So Monday through Thursday, we'll give you an early dinner duo. On the business side, in the B2B world, where we have various channel members, we might offer them discounts for helping us out in getting the product out to the ultimate consumer. So we might talk about trade or functional discounts. These are reductions in list prices that we offer to our distribution channel members for helping us out, for performing some function for us in the future. For example, I make a bunch of stuff. And eventually it's going to be ordered somewhere. It's going to, you know, go down the channel of distribution. Until it's ordered, it's got to sit in my warehouse. That costs money. Sitting in a warehouse, I got to pay for storage. I got to pay maybe taxes on the inventory I'm holding. I got to pay for insurance. Tell you what, you're going to eventually order some of this from me anyhow to ship down to the retailer. How about you order it now? You warehouse some of it, and I'll give you a little price reduction because I don't want to pay for all that housing, all that warehousing. That would be the idea of a functional discount. Trade discounts can be combined to include a series of functions that channel member or channel members provide. The book talks about things like a 2012-5 series of discounts. So we're going to give a 20% discount to our channel member if they'll warehouse the product for us. That's pretty good, 20% off. Another 12% if they'll deal with shipping. I don't want to mess with shipping. I got a schedule. I got to have trucks coming in. I got to have a loading dock ready. I got to have people ready to load. You do that, 12%. And what a pain it is. I'm in a 700 stores. How am I going to make sure my inventory is on the shelf all the time? Because I don't want to lose sales in the store. Am I going to have to send people out to 700 stores to tell you what I'm going to do? you make sure that I'm stocked, and I'll give you another discount. So we have 5% discount for keeping our shelves stocked. So 2012-5 would play out like that. Looking at it arithmetically, let's look all the way out to the retail price, the manufacturer suggested retail price at the store, and we say 20% off of that for warehousing it. So 20% of that is $40 profit for you to warehouse it for me. That seems pretty good. And so the retailer cost is now $160. They sell it for $200. They've just made an additional $40. Then we have 12% off for shipping the product, and we let the wholesaler do that for us. So that's a $19.20 profit to the wholesaler. Yay them. So that's $140.80 to the wholesaler from us. And then we're going to have somebody called a rack jobber keep our shelves stocked, and that's $7.04 to the rack jobber for that thing. So the jobber's cost in this case is the manufacturer's selling price into the channel, and that's $133.76. So that's the 2012-5 example of these chained discounts off of our suggested list price, and it just helps shift some of the burden down the channel. If you looked on page 396, 397, you'd see a very comparable example, the 30-10-5 in the textbook. Again, based on the manufacturer's suggested retail price, same logic applies there. Same arithmetic would apply there. I would love for you to pay me in cash when I ship this order out to you. Especially in the B2B world, those invoices can be pretty big. What happens if you don't pay me in cash? You want to pay me in 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? What happens to me as the supplier? So your invoice is $200,000. So what happens to me if I'm the manufacturer and you don't pay me for 30, 60, or 90 days? I'm short $200,000. Do I have a use for that money? Yeah, I got to make salary. I got to pay the rent. I got to order in new stuff. And since I don't have that money, what am I going to have to do? Likely. Go in the savings or get a loan to have the money to keep the thing rolling. It's worth it to me to give you a bit of a discount if you'll pay me now in cash, right? Because I don't have to do these other things. So a cash discount makes sense there. Or we might give you an allowance off-list price for helping us to promote our product. So we could give you a promotional allowance. I'll give you a certain percentage off your list cost if you advertise it to the retailer, or if the retailer advertises it out to the consumer. Or, of course, we're all familiar with the trade-in allowance, bring you back an old version of the product, which I'll recycle or reuse, and I'll give you an allowance there, too. So those are special adjustments out to the list or quoted price. Geographic adjustments. So I sell you a product. When is it yours? When is it yours? I'm talking about the B2B world. When is it yours? Well, it's an interesting legal question, but it has some practical implications as well. So FOB origin, free onboard origin, the shipping cost is from the factory or the warehouse, and it's paid by the buyer. Paid by the buyer. So if I'm in Kent, Ohio, manufacturing my Mark's Magnificent T-shirts, and you order them from me by the box or truckload in Akron, how much is shipping? I don't know how much it is, but it can't be a lot. You order the same carload, and I got to ship it to Los Angeles, it's going to cost a lot more, right? So different people in different geographic locations are going to end up paying different shipping costs. Now, importantly, ownership of the goods is transferred to the buyer as soon as it leaves my warehouse or my factory. Why is ownership of a product important to anyone? Yeah. Liability. What happens if it is stolen, damaged, burns up, its fresh fruit in the refrigeration fails? Who has liability for that? Me? No, no. FOB, it's you. It was on route. So important to know these things for very practical details. Who's responsible? Now, depending on our personal relationship in the B2B world, either the buyer or the seller can arrange for the transportation. That would be agreed on. But once it's on board, it's yours. Bye. So here we're showing a little visual learner sort of thing. Here we are at our, what does that say? At our seller. Here we see it being transferred, the title and the goods, right at the seller's warehouse. And off it goes. It's the buyer's goods till it gets to the buyer and beyond. FOB origin. Uniform delivery pricing. In this case, the shipping cost from the factory to the warehouse is included in the selling price. And here, again, importantly, ownership of the goods is not transferred to the buyer until they get it. So I have liability until it's in your hands. And since it's my product, I'll arrange for the shipping. Thank you. I'll arrange for the transportation. In single zone pricing, the same price is charged to all buyers regardless of their location. We have the idea of the postage stamp. Anybody know what a first class stamp costs these days? I do not. Anybody know? Let's pretend, because I don't know what it costs. It's 52 cents for a first class stamp. Okay. How much does it cost for me to mail a stamp from my office, mail an envelope from my office to downtown Kent? In my example. Am I talking too fast? It takes one stamp. How much does it cost? Thank you, 52 cents. How much does it cost for me to mail it all the way to Los Angeles? In my example, 52 cents. So it's included in the price, and it's the same for everybody everywhere. On the other hand, that may not be practical. What you're shipping is big and bulky. It costs a lot of money depending where you're shipping it. So multiple zone pricing, we have a situation where prices increase as the shipping distances increase. Sometimes we do this just by drawing circles on a map. We're at the center, zone A, zone B, zone Z. So our warehouse or our plant defines the center point, and we have boundaries based on those circles. Or if we really have something that's hard to ship, we might have irregularly shaped pricing boundaries based on the geography, how hard it is to get the product to you over those mountains. Population density, it takes a long time to get it out to your rural farm or ranch. Transportation infrastructure, and of course the actual literal shipping cost itself. So here's an example of using circular pricing boundaries to ship from my Cleveland plant. And I'm going to ship it out. The base price is $100. If you're in Chicago, you can see you're in zone one. So how much am I going to charge you? Well, it's $10 in zone one. So it's $110. If I'm shipping to St. Louis, you can see they're in zone two. So they're going to pay the base price of $100 plus my $20 charge, $120. And zone three, which is not supposed to imply Mexico and the Pacific Ocean, zone three is $30. So Seattle customer is going to pay $130. Los Angeles customer is going to pay $130 based on how much it cost me to ship this thing out. Yeah? Different people pay different amounts based on where they are geographically. Another approach is called basing point pricing. In this case, certain cities are designated as basing points. I have a plant in different cities. I have warehouses in different cities. The product's already there in that city. And so what I'll do is all the goods that are shipped from that basis point are charged the same amount no matter how near or far the customer is from the base city is this approach. So in this case, St. Louis, my plant in St. Louis, is my basing point. And I'm going to charge $120 to all regardless of the actual freight cost. So the actual freight cost out to, I don't know, Cleveland, Chicago, they pay $120 even though the freight cost is $10. My freight cost to Seattle is $30, but I'm discounting them, only $120 to them. And my freight cost to LA is $20 and they paid $120. So if you get shipped from St. Louis for whatever reason, you're going to pay $120 no matter what the actual freight shipping costs are. Basing point pricing. Freight absorption pricing, this is where the seller absorbs all or part of the cost of transportation. What do you look forward to over the holiday season? Don't you look forward to the selling price with shipping costs included? You ever see that as a promotional thing? No? Yeah, one person's seen it. Okay, yeah, you. And so that's a sort of thing we see in the B2C world. So we use it as a promotional tactic. The buyer might reason that if they can get more business, its overall cost will decrease, and it'll more than compensate for that free extra freight giveaway. It's used for market penetration. We're trying to get more and more people to come to our shop, plant, website, and we're trying to hold an increasingly competitive market, get more people to buy from us. So freight absorbent pricing. Then the relatively new approach, personalized dynamic pricing. Until recently, when computers and bots, etc., were running rampant through the world, once we set our price, they remain fairly consistent for a pretty long time period. And we talked about why there's a cost of changing prices, changing the web price, changing brochures, getting the word out. But with digital advances on the web, on the internet, there are more opportunities to adjust price to reflect the value of experiences to consumers. I have a new video, as you can see down there. It says new video. It's a little long, and I haven't actually edited it yet, so I'm going to bring it up, and we'll decide when we get bored of it. But it does talk about this idea of dynamic pricing, and maybe we'll like the whole thing. That's how excited we are. If you doze off, though, I'm cutting it out. Let's take a look at it and see how it works for us.
On a Monday at 3 p.m., outside of rush hour traffic, a car from Times Square to Central Park in New York might cost you around $17. Now fast forward 3 hours. As more people are looking for cars, that same ride might cost closer to $24. If you've taken a trip like this or bought a plane ticket, you know to expect big price swings based on demand, time, or location. But did you know that those price swings are happening all over the economy, and often in places where you might not expect, like on your laundry detergent or even a blouse? These changes are part of a high-tech and fast-spreading strategy called dynamic pricing. And as prices around us are rising faster than they have in four decades, to understand why things cost what they do, you have to understand how it works. Dynamic pricing is a strategy businesses use to change their prices automatically and ensure that they are offering the optimal price at any given moment in time.
And that basically means that they're varying their pricing essentially based upon market conditions. So things like cost, what their competitors are doing, and even demand.
Because those factors can change quickly, some businesses are updating prices more often. In February, 75% of retailers on QuickLizard, a pricing software platform, said they increased how often they update their prices in the last year. So where can you spot dynamic pricing other than rideshare companies and airlines? You probably recognize it with gas prices, where the price of a gallon can change daily. Or on Amazon, which has been using dynamic pricing for years. Their changes are usually less noticeable, but they allow Amazon to determine the most competitive price for everything from electronics to household items. For example, here's the price of these Tide Pods over a day at the beginning of April. In the morning, it hit $21.49. By noon, it dropped to $21.24. And by evening, it had dropped even lower, to $19.99. A spokesperson from Amazon said the company's prices fluctuate so they can meet or beat the lowest competitive price from other retailers. But this is what dynamic pricing looks like in action, and you may start seeing similar strategies in brick-and-mortar stores, too. Chains like Kohl's and Best Buy have rolled out electronic price tags, some of which almost look like paper price tags, making it easier and quicker to change the price on, say, a display of televisions.
All right, so I'm at Best Buy, and they got Lego, and that's cool and all, but check it out. They're moving to all digital price tags.
And the supermarket chain Kroger has tested digital labels that can change prices on items in seconds. But seeing these frequent price changes in stores can be surprising for customers.
If you chat with someone who's in the grocery store on a week-to-week basis, They know how much they're paying for a dozen eggs. They know how much they're paying for a gallon of milk. They know how much they're paying for, you know, their fruits, their vegetables. And when those types of prices change, people can be very resistant and it can be a big turnoff.
But under certain conditions, companies are willing to take the risk.
Companies will go to dynamic pricing when more traditional ways of pricing are no longer working for them. So maybe they have previously changed their prices once a quarter, maybe once a month, and they're starting to notice that their costs are shifting so much throughout the month or the quarter that their margins are getting squeezed more than they would like.
When most businesses decide to start using dynamic pricing, they use software to track various factors.
There will be a range, a huge number of algorithms whose role is, again, to mimic the choices that humans make. But because it's being done in an automated way, we're able to set prices much more frequently or much more granularly than if you're doing it without the automation.
A dynamic pricing algorithm for a gas station might look at the cost of fuel, competitor prices, and alternatives that customers might have.
What dynamic pricing would allow me to do is, instead of having, you know, a single point of view that is driven by the price of crude, I actually could have a very granular point of view on individual competitors and what my delivered cost is of the fuel, and then execute those price changes on a very frequent basis.
But that algorithm might look different for a grocery store. They might look at competitor prices, but they also might consider cost of goods and what they know customers are willing to pay more on. But even if a business uses dynamic pricing, those rules might not affect everything you buy there.
There are a few exceptions where prices are largely fixed and they're actually being set by the manufacturer. Examples of that would be jeans. There's certain types of sneakers or athletic apparel where the manufacturer also sets the prices. And then prestige cosmetics is a third where you see a lot of manufacturer set pricing. But beyond that, where the retailer is actually able to set their price, you know, dynamic pricing can be applicable across the store.
As more companies use dynamic pricing, you might start noticing it more often, especially during periods of inflation like the one we're in now.
You could be, you know, visiting a store that has been using dynamic pricing for a long time, but now you're noticing that the prices of things are changing a lot. And that's not because they're doing something different. That's because the inputs are changing more frequently.
The adoption of dynamic pricing is expected to continue, and mom-and-pop shops and local retailers are starting to experiment with it, as well as big box stores.
Well, that sort of gave some insights. A little long. You stayed awake there, right? Yeah. So, so that gives us a little insight into personalized dynamic pricing. So companies like Amazon can and do monitor prices 24/7. Then they have huge amounts of data that they can bring in and look to see what the competition is doing, what consumers are doing, when they're buying, how much they're paying. And so they can make these changes faster and more granular, as the lady just talked about, on a more regular basis, which they do. So here is us talking to people thinking about doing dynamic pricing and building it into the design of their consumer experiences. First, you have to rethink your mindset about pricing. We're no longer talking about changing prices once a month or once a quarter. We're going to move away from aligning our price just to the cost of the product alone. In fact, price is a reflection and a quantifiable measure of the customer experience. People are willing to pay more money at the theater in the evening, an airline ticket that they buy on short notice, hotel room in Florida in the winter. It's their experience, and they're willing to pay more for that. So as the experience changes, so should the price that's attached to it. Walk in the customer's shoes. Consider all the factors that influence that buying experience, as well as the potential effects that a change in sales context might have on customer expectations. At the same time, identify the data sources that enable a deeper appreciation of buyers' lives, the environment in which they live, the issues they face, their moods or mindsets at the point of sale. How do I feel about buying diapers that I really need in this inflationary period, and when do I really want to buy them? In the middle of the night, in the morning, when's it more important to me? Armed with those insights, segment consumers more precisely and more empathetically, create product and pricing that offers that best meet their needs. harmonize pricing experience, gain affinity, and grow revenue by fairly correlating prices with the level of experience that's delivered through your different channels. Maybe we have to reconsider the channel strategy, and maybe, for example, create online brands to reach customers who are more interested in reliable supply or low price than they are in the shopping experience, and have a different price for people who really want to be in the store, talking to a salesperson, trying it on, feeling, tasting it. But make sure your offline and online experience work to complement, not contradict each other. Build the right team, invest in building the skills needed to convert data, data analytics, data sciences, CIS people, into prices and experiences that consumers want and are willing to pay for. And then focus on executional excellence. Speed is a critical component of dynamic pricing. Make sure the feedback mechanisms are in place to enable fast price changes that are accurate. So invest in the right tools and technologies. Build agility in the organization. Experiences are liquid. Prices are liquid. The organization that enables this fluidity must also be liquid too. Break down barriers that often stymie the delivery of high-quality consumer experiences by making sure that marketing, supply chain, customer service, financing, logistics, and other areas are aligned. Remember, we talked about integrated marketing mix aligned to the dynamic pricing strategy. Sales and marketing leaders have long known that price and experience are intricately bound together. Consumer packaged goods that adopt dynamic pricing will be able to compete in entirely new ways and use customer affinity to drive growth. With pricing that accurately and fairly reflects the value of the customer shopping experience, they create mutually beneficial outcomes for themselves and for their consumers. So this is one example of a dynamic pricing experience. So here we see a GE microwave on August 12th. Out at web retailers. Sears best price on the web at midnight is $899.99. Sears best price at noon is $800.99. Sears best price at 11 p.m. is $899.99. You can see Sears is not heavily engaged in dynamic pricing, yeah? So then we have Best Buy. Best Buy undercuts Sears to begin with at $809.99, and then based on some consumer behavior, maybe when people in the evening are looking for microwave ovens and excited to get it, they boost their price to match Sears. Their algorithm is looking at Sears. They swing around, and they keep their price adjusted until 7 p.m., and then they come back down to their best price of $899.99. Amazon takes a different approach. They start at 7:44:46. They change at 5 a.m. They change at 7. They change at 9. They drop way down. They change at 11:30, et cetera, et cetera. So they're making 9 price changes based on their algorithm compared to competition and what consumers are doing over the time period that we're talking about. Obviously, they have to have some sort of automation out there watching that, because they're not just doing one microwave oven, right? They're doing thousands of products all at the same time. How does this make sense? Why bother? So let's look at the logic behind dynamic pricing. Beyond the point where costs have been covered, as the number of price points relative to an existing fixed price level increase, so do the potential profits. So we've covered our cost at whatever dollar amount this is, and now we've set a single selling price. So this is our profit at that single selling price. Could we perhaps sell more down here and down here and down here? Maybe we could. Could we pick up some additional profit? Well, it seems like we could, relatively speaking. So here we find this single block of profit at one selling price, but it turns out that we also could make profit in this example of selling some at a higher price when people really, really want the thing. So we're passing up profit by not engaging in appropriate dynamic pricing that matches what consumers are willing to pay given their situation. So the more price points we have, as long as they're working for the consumer, the more profit we bring in. This is my existing video on the topic, and it talks a little bit about Amazon in particular and their dynamic pricing.
Amazon's tremendous success in many ways foots back to the reputation it has earned as a low-cost player in the retail world. 95% of beauty products are priced lower on Amazon than any other online retailer. The same is true for 90% of hair care products and even 81% of low-margin personal care products. Amazon keeps its prices low through a variety of mechanisms. A key component about the platform is that both Amazon itself can sell its own inventory and millions of third-party merchants can sell theirs on the same platform. Amazon prices its inventory using a unique price-matching crawler that scans e-tailers across the web to find the lowest prices for a product. Amazon then uses this information to price its own products to ensure that it is always offering the lowest prices. Amazon is currently estimated to adjust its prices more than 2.5 million times per day. It does this for products of both brands that have chosen to officially distribute on Amazon, such as Procter & Gamble's Olay, as well as those who have not, for example, Estee Lauder. Amazon's third-party marketplace also ensures that prices stay low on the platform. A key component is that multiple merchants can sell the same product. These merchants, however, have to compete to win the buy box on a listing. Amazon's buy box algorithm considers many seller factors when trying to decide who wins a listing. Many of these are based on past seller performance, such as total sales volume or reviews. However, price is also strongly considered and is the factor over which a third-party merchant has the most immediate influence. A classic invisible hand scenario, the level of competition in a sector, the number of suppliers offering a particular product, is strongly correlated with the average discount available for that product. Third-party pricing on Amazon feeds back into the price crawler that Amazon uses to determine the pricing on its own inventory. So the activity of third-party merchants helps keep Amazon's own prices low.
So Amazon pretty well has this idea locked down and is making 2.5 million price changes a day. So obviously they believe in the concept, and it must be working for them in terms of profitability. Pricing is an interesting way to get yourself into legal trouble. So you have a course on whatever we call business law, but let's pay attention to this a little bit. One way you can get yourself into trouble is by price fixing. This is where you get together with the competition and agree on what price everybody will be charged in your industry. In October of 2020, of all things, Pilgrim's Pride agreed to pay $110 million to settle charges of fixing chicken prices in the industry. One of the largest... you aren't going to let me see it. All right, because I'm not going to subscribe now. So they all get together with the competition in the field and were cheating by having fixed prices for chicken. Also, you can't actually enforce specific prices within the channel legally. The best you can do is have a strongly stated, manufactured, suggested retail price. Unless you own the channel, you can't make them pay attention. Now, you can always take your product away if they refuse to uphold your price. But you can't force them to charge your price. Price discrimination is another legal issue. You charge different prices to buyers when there are no differences in the grade of the product, the quality of the product, or the cost of the product that results in substantially lessening competition. Last time, though, we talked about a very common consumer example of a fairly expensive purchase where different people do pay different amounts for the same product. You remember what we talked about last time? Pretty expensive consumer product. Maybe you remember, yeah? Cars. So you buy a car and I buy a car and it's the same model car and you're shrewder than I am. So you get a better deal than I do. Why isn't that illegal? But still, two different people are paying a different price for the same product. Seems like that would be price discrimination. What's the trick in the sentence there? In the rule? That substantially eliminates, lessens competition. That's not lessening competition. There are lots of car dealers. They're all dealing with one another. You and I negotiating that price isn't really killing competition. So the concern is that we're harming competition with these special deals. Not the case. Engaging in deceptive pricing is also illegal. Bait and switch. You advertise that you have a 62-inch HD flat-screen TV in your store for $195. Might you be interested in such a deal? Yeah. And when you get there, what do they tell you? Oh, man, we sold that out. But let me show you this one over here for $999. We bait you in, and then we try to switch you out. Illegal. Now, what we can legitimately say is that flat screen TV I described, there's only five of them available in the store. All right, now a reasonable consumer can understand when they get there, it might be gone. Bargains conditioned on purchasing overpriced products. So you go in and you buy the particular brand of printer, but all of their ink supplies are way over the market price. So the only way you get a deal here is by agreeing to that other overcharged thing. No good. Fake sales off of prices never really offered. So you'll see sometimes with a legitimate retailer, they'll say something like 30% off manufactured suggested retail price. And then in the fine print, but still there, may not have been offered at the manufactured suggested retail price in all our stores. So they're following the law. But you can't have a fake sale off of a price that you nowhere you ever offered it. Predatory pricing, offering low prices to drive out competition and then raise prices. When Walmart comes into a town, don't they offer up low prices? Walmart? You've heard of Walmart, right? Don't they offer up low prices? Do they drive out competition when that happens? People are afraid to nod. Yes, they do. So why aren't they charged with predatory pricing? You're reading the rest of the sentence. Because they don't then, having driven out competition, they don't then come back and raise up the pricing. If you do that, you're engaged in predatory pricing and subject to legal action. So there are a whole bunch of things that fit in this category. Again, it's in the book and therefore testable. Also, hopefully you'll cover these in your business law course. But we see the issues of vertical price fixing, horizontal price fixing, predatory pricing, geographic pricing that isn't legal, price discrimination we just talked about, deceptive pricing, all these things are problems that you can get yourself into trouble with. So you have to be a little careful as you think about the pricing issue. So far we've talked about product and service, one of the four P's of marketing, and we've talked about pricing, a second of the four P's of pricing. We now move on to a third P of the marketing mix, managing marketing channels and supply chains, chapter 15, lecture notes, page 216. Once again, hopefully this is looking a little familiar by now. We're looking at the framework for strategic marketing. Started at the 30,000-foot level, worked our way down to the 20,000-foot level above your everyday job. Now we're probably down at the 10,000-foot level, looking at product or service, pricing, and place or distribution as part of the marketing mix. Yep. And, of course, who's at the center of our decision-making, hopefully? The consumer and their experiences. So what's happened to our poor supply chains during the pandemic? It's killing people, as you know. All that's getting a little better, right? So the supply chain is how we get nearly all the stuff in our lives that we want and need. It's a system that helps make and deliver our favorite products. It involves, well, yeah, the manufacturers of the products, the companies that supply the materials to the manufacturers to make the products, the cargo ships, the trains, the trucks that deliver them to the manufacturer and then from the manufacturer, and, of course, the stores that sell those products out. This, as we've come to realize more and more recently, is a complex network of various different entities that usually work together to enable us as consumers to receive our products in the time that we expect. But certainly, as you've noticed in the past, and still in some areas today, the pandemic has disrupted nearly every aspect of the global supply chain. Many factories, especially in China and South Korea, are shut down or were forced to reduce production because workers were sick or in lockdown. I digress to see who's staying up with current affairs. What policy has China just announced it's changing that's relevant to all of this? Anybody a global type person following the news? No? So until recently, they had a zero tolerance for any COVID cases. If anyone had a COVID case, they shut down like the city. People were locked into their buildings. Everything closed. And you got some big cities in China. I think we mentioned that people were locked into Disney World there. Did we mention that in passing? There were a couple cases of COVID. They locked people into Disney World in China and wouldn't let them go until they had like 3 negative COVID tests. But in cities, nothing was happening. Well, it affects us in the U.S. and our supply chain. But it was also, of course, killing their economy, too. So most recently, they've announced a less stringent COVID policy. We'll see how it works for them because they got a lot of people. And hopefully, it'll help their economy, which is in tanking, and ours, too. So we'll see what happens. In response, then, shipping companies, because nothing was happening, they cut their schedules in anticipation of a drop in demand for moving goods around the world. And that was a terrible mistake because then when demand came back, there was nothing available, no trucks, planes, boats available to ship. Americans took the money that they used to spend outside the home and redirected it to goods for their homes, which were suddenly doubling as offices and classrooms. So now we had a steep surge in demand that clogged up the system for transporting goods to the factories that needed them. At the same time, the finished products, many of them made in China, piled up in warehouses and at ports throughout Asia because of the profound shortage of shipping containers, which are those steel-sized boxes that carry goods on the big vessels. At the same time, truck drivers and dock workers were stuck in quarantine, reducing the availability of people to unload goods and further slowing the process. So the pandemic has certainly made supply and demand extremely volatile, shifting faster than our supply chain can adjust. So really important stuff in the running of our economy and in you and I getting toilet paper and perfume. So the pandemic resulted in remarkable shifts in supply and demand. Toilet paper, underlying demand didn't change. People still needed toilet paper. But how they consumed toilet paper did change. Businesses, hotels, and restaurants were closed. And suddenly, people are consuming their toilet paper at their home. Doesn't seem like a big deal, except institutional toilet paper uses different brands, different diameter rolls, different quantities than you use at home. So the retail supply chain wasn't set up for this shift. And people at home wanted some control, so they began to hoard toilet paper. Did anybody's family hoard toilet paper, buy many, many extra, just one person during the pandemic? Only one person. I think my wife bought a few extra rolls, too. A shift in how consumption happens, plus an increase in demand, because people are hoarding, resulted in empty toilet paper shelves at the store. Ouch. Bicycles. You couldn't find a bicycle during the pandemic at one point in time. Many bikes were made in China, but they were under lockdown in January and February of 21, so bikes weren't made then. So they didn't get shipped to the distribution centers in March and April. And there was a supply shortage. Add to that, there's a lot of people at home. They want to get outside and do something that they can do in a socially distanced way. So demand for bicycles went up. There's less supply and a whole lot more demand. And there's a reason why you can walk into Walmart at that time and not see a single bike on the shelf. Supply chain issues. So anticipating stock and supply chain issues, several retailers offered Black Friday 2021 deals very early. Best Buy and Walmart hosted Black Friday deals on tech, home, and fashion. Meanwhile, shoppers could snag Amazon deals on a wide range of products, including the then new Apple AirPods during the retailer's Epic Deals event. During this sale, Amazon had both week-long discounts and one-day sales. Black Friday is rolling around. Some people have already, this year, released early Black Friday sales. There's a big question about how Black Friday is going to play out this year in terms of retail sales. Why? What's the big concern? Not so much supply chain right now. Still some. Why are retailers concerned, do you think, this year? Poor retailers, they're having a tough time. Inflation is making people cautious. And when they're spending money, what are they spending money on? More necessities, less luxuries, less clothing, you know, fashion, electronic part, more basic stuff. I debated about when to bring in what's happened just recently to Kohl's. We talked about it in passing. I'll mention it here and then I'll mention it again later. Kohl's profit halved after they had to have discounts to sell off a whole bunch of inventory, though I think we talked about previously, that wasn't going anywhere. Meanwhile, Walmart is doing okay. Why is that? Turns out, when you think about it, Walmart not only sells clothes and electronics the way Kohl's does, they sell a whole bunch of basic products that people are shifting their expenditures to. They're doing okay. Kohl's and other retailers are having problems. So we'll see what happens this Black Friday overall. But there's concern, the high inflation, shifting consumers' demand and what they're spending money on. So what's going to happen? We'll see as a result of all this. Arguably, there's been discussion about us reshoring, instead of offshoring, reshoring some of our items. A move away from focusing on something we talked about previously, just-in-time and just-in-sequence manufacturing. The shift to online and omnichannel retailing, we'll talk about that in chapter 17, will continue. So curbside pickup, shipping from the store, getting your groceries delivered, that's changing for a lot of firms, and that's going to be something where firms are going to be making investments, we think. Supply chains will be going digital, might be moving slowly. There was a lot of paper in supply chains. Invoices and shipping documents were still being done on paper. People had to sign for things, especially in big corporate offices. That's shifting quite a bit, but you're going to need people to help manage that, make sure that there's still good control of these kinds of things. So again, CIS folks. Having a strong, resilient supply chain is really important for firms. You're going to be making investments in that. It's become more and more visible. Stay tuned for the future. Let's back up a little bit in time before we had to worry about pandemics and talk about the old school way that the supply chains work. So traditionally, you would have a manufacturer, wholesaler, retailer, not all on the same page, not all working together for efficient and fast shipment of product. Each one was looking out for themselves. So there was actually a bit of an adversarial relationship in the channel, which meant things didn't necessarily flow efficiently, didn't necessarily flow in a cost-effective way. Walmart, a pretty big company, recognized that this traditional adversarial relationship was outmoded, and it actually hurt both the supplier, the manufacturer, and the store. So with their channel power, they, quote, invited their major suppliers to jointly develop powerful supply chain partnerships with them. And if you wanted to work with Walmart, you probably paid attention to that invitation, yeah? So the idea was that they would increase product flow efficiency and so would increase profitability both for the manufacturer and for the retailer. The Walmart Procter & Gamble Alliance, for example, incorporated vendor-managed inventory, category management, and other intercompany innovations so they were no longer fighting with each other. Procter & Gamble was working with Walmart to get the product out to the consumer. In fact, Procter & Gamble had a dedicated account team in Bentonville, Arkansas. What's in Bentonville, Arkansas? Why is that important? Let me come up here. Thank you. It's the Walmart headquarters. Thank you very much. And so they actually put it. And where's P&G headquartered? Nobody knows where P&G is headquartered. I think we mentioned it here before. Make it a test question. Say it again. Cincinnati, whoever you are. Thank you. Thank you. So we move our team from Cincinnati, where normally we would have operated in the traditional way, and we put them in our channel partners' headquarters in Bentonville, Texas, so they're working together. And the team members represented key functions from P&G, sales and marketing, distribution, supply chain management, IT and finance, and Walmart's chief financial officer became a customer for Procter & Gamble's objective to maximize Walmart's internal profitability, which meant P&G was selling a boatload of product through Walmart by this cooperation. What day is today? Wednesday? I feel like we should call it a day. Let's call it a day. Happy Wednesday.